Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today I'll be taking time to speak with Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and fellow at the Urban Institute, Gene Sturley. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. A $4.5 billion emergency spending package for migrants at the U.S. southern border is being worked on in the House. The current bill seems short on bipartisan support compared to a similar bill being crafted in the Senate. The two will likely have to be reconciled without the addition of, quote, poison pill amendments. Congress hopes to have a bill passed before the July 4th recess, which is important because the Department of Health and Human Services has warned that its Office of Refugee Resettlement could run out of money by the end of this month without additional funds. The House is slated to pass a spending package containing 5 of the 12 annual appropriations bills, a total spending package of $322 billion for fiscal year 2020. The House took up amendments last week on the military construction VA portion of the package and debated whether to include medical marijuana for veterans. The author of the amendment withdrew it after the VA objected, saying it could not make recommendations to veterans concerning medical marijuana because cannabis is still prohibited under federal law. The House will consider amendments to other portions of the bill this week. A different set of appropriations bills, a $985 billion spending package, passed last week on party lines. Both packages assume a higher level of discretionary spending than allowed under spending caps imposed by a 2011 deficit reduction law. There is still no bipartisan agreement to raise those caps, however. But congressional leaders are hoping to negotiate spending limits soon. As they do so, some policymakers are looking for areas of cost savings. Any bipartisan deal to boost caps will likely require some offsetting cuts or revenue increases to satisfy Republican members. Most recent budget deals, increasing discretionary spending caps, have included similar program cuts and revenue raisers. That was not the case for the 2018 deal, however. The Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget released a paper last week that laid out a path to fully offset any cap increase. The Trump administration may redefine how the federal poverty thresholds are determined, likely by utilizing a slower-growing inflation index than what is currently used. Some say the proposal could end up reducing the number of people eligible for programs like Medicaid, the Children's Health Insurance Program, and food stamps. Others say the current system overestimates inflation, increasing the cost of those programs. The Supreme Court will weigh in on the power of policy writers in congressional spending bills. The High Court will determine if policymakers can repeal parts of the Affordable Care Act that obligates government reimbursement payments to insurance companies by adding riders to spending bills. The dispute is over $12 billion in payments being sought by insurance companies. Instead of passing legislation to amend the ACA, Congress used riders and appropriations bills to block DHHS from paying out certain reimbursements. A federal circuit court previously sided with Congress. Up next, Concord's Executive Director Bob Bixby and Gene Sturley will join me to discuss Gene's book, Dead Men Ruling, and its application to present-day fiscal policy. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and Gene Sturley. Gene is a fellow and the Richard B. Fisher Chair at the Urban Institute. He was also a Deputy Assistant Secretary of the U.S. Department of Treasury for Tax Analysis. president of the National Tax Association, co-director of the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center, chair of the 1999 technical panel advising Social Security, and more. He's also served on a variety of boards and committees. Gene is the author, co-author, or co-editor of 18 books, including Dead Men Ruling. Welcome to Facing the Future, Bob and Gene.
Thanks, Chase.
Thanks, Chase. Glad to be here.
Great to have you both on the show. And Gene, I read Dead Men Ruling a few years ago when it was first published, and I found it both sobering and enlightening. Today, I'd like to discuss the book's applicability to present day. But before we do that, maybe you could give a brief summary of the premise of Dead Men Ruling and the message you were trying to communicate with it.
Well, the title in some ways reflects the theme of the book, which is that dead men, and they were men, there weren't a lot of women then, who are ruling over policy, but today they're ruling over policy, and they're doing that largely by a competition that's taken place over several decades in which both political parties have more and more attempted to control the future, partly to achieve their own agenda and partly to prevent the other party from getting anywhere. But the net result of all that is that they've so locked in the budget that they pre-committed not only all the additional resources that government expects to get into the future, but more than that. And what that creates is an interesting deficit problem, and it's not the traditional deficit problem. The traditional deficit problem was that a Congress or a legislature or whoever was in power would be profligate year after year, each year adding new benefits or cutting revenues below what they were paying out to try to meet some new standard for that year. In this new world, the pre-commitment is so large that all the additional revenues that government projects getting essentially are pre-committed by decisions made in the past, in some cases several decades in the past, into programs that have fairly strong and automatic growth rates. And this creates a dynamic we'll probably discuss about a little more as we go along. But it's a new dynamic, and it's one that we simply haven't solved. We're not ruling over ourselves.
So, Gene, just to pick up on that, you mentioned that the budget was sort of locked in already, and you alluded to a handful of programs that grow automatically. Is that what you were referring to when it comes to being locked in? Can you explain that dynamic a little bit for us?
Right. Well, when Congress decides that it's going to build growth rates into programs, it passes a law, whatever, 1965, 1990, whenever. But that law then creates the following not only economic but political dynamic, that if you decided you want to do something new, maybe you want to cut back on the size of government by reducing taxes, maybe you want to increase spending on workers or our children, who, by the way, are taking the sharp shrift in this budget, it's very hard to do because the additional revenues that economic growth makes possible has already been built into the law. Now, you want to change that. Yes, technically speaking, it's possible to change it. Government doesn't have to spend those revenues or doesn't have to meet those obligations. But if it does so, it's got to go to the public and say, first, we're going to renege on the promises we made to you. And second, to achieve this, we've got to get a majority at the federal level in both houses of Congress in the president's support. So now you have to have a supermajority to cut back on automatic growth in programs. You need a type of supermajority. By supermajority, I mean getting both houses of Congress and the president on board to actually do anything new. And so it creates a very strong bias in the system, a built-in bias towards decisions made in the past, and a hard set of political hurdles to overcome or to jump to be able to do something new and different because current voters want to do something new or different, or simply because that's the need or demands of the time.
Gene, you mentioned in Dead Men Ruling the nation being at a fiscal turning point. And you wrote those words 4 or 5 years ago now. Are we still at that fiscal turning point? Has it worsened? Has it gotten any better?
It's worsened. The reason I say we're at a turning point is simply that we have to make some changes. Whether we do them well is still an open question, but among the implications of this system, certainly the Concord Coalition points out continually, is the size of the deficits, and not just their current size, but their built-in growth into the future. And that's simply unsustainable. So that means we are at a turning point. In the early part of the book, I do recount some other points in history where we were facing such a fiscal turning point. Perhaps the best example being right at the founding of the nation or the new government. And it took us quite a while to be able to establish a fiscal regime that was going to work and overcome the dilemma that we were in under the Articles of Confederation and the attempted legislative control that occurred during the Revolutionary War when we couldn't even pay our soldiers.
And diving into that fiscal turning point and just a little bit more, you mentioned the growth of budget deficits. Certainly the debt is growing as a result of that and how it's unsustainable. How long do you think we can hang on? Like, what period of time do you think this fiscal turning point will exist? Is there a point of no return? Or is this something that because we're the world's largest economy and we're given quite a bit of leeway in terms of how we handle debt, that it's sort of a death by a thousand cuts sort of situation?
That's hard. That's like trying to project when the next recession is going to occur, when the next stock market
fair
is going
enough,
to crash.
Fair enough.
I would point out, though, that even if we don't have a crash, that I view this as a budget for a declining economy. So one consequence could be we just have very low growth rates, partly because the way we're spending this money is not promoting mobility, opportunity for many people in society. Most of the built-in growth, by the way, is in the area of health and retirement, which programs certainly that need to be supported, but many of which are not promoting growth, particularly because most of that spending is going to us after we retire. So it's not encouraging us to work longer. It's not doing much to increase our educational opportunities as a nation. And so we're on a declining growth rate, even if we don't get a crash.
Gene, this is Bob. I think one of the things that a real insight in your book is a different way of looking at the budget than people, including the Concord Coalition, traditionally do, in that you on the one hand, take an optimistic look and say, we're a nation with robust growth. I mean, we can look forward to a growing economy, and yet so much of that benefit from that growth is already pre-committed. And that seems to be the central insight in your book. But it's just this, the extent to which we're going to have a lot of growth in the future and we're not deciding what we want to do with that growth, those decisions have already been made for people Chase's age and younger.
Right. Well, I mean, think of any firm or household that would project they were going to have increased revenues or increased wages in the case of a household going out 10 or 20 years into the future. And it signed contracts today for how every dollar of those wages would be spent plus some additional amounts. Well, that's fairly obviously inefficient in terms of what's being projected simply because we don't know the future. You know, we don't know quite what the opportunities are going to be in the future. So that's where I say that this particular pattern ends up creating a budget for a declining economy. So give some numbers along the lines of your question, Bob. If you take the Congressional Budget Office's current projections for 10 years from today, so they compare 2018 to 2029, we're in 2019 now, so 11 years from 2018, they project that we'll have maybe $1.2 trillion more in revenues. You could do a lot with $1.2 trillion.
Yeah, that's good.
And that's at a fairly modest growth rate compared to the past. However, of that 1.2, about 1.5 has been committed. So we not only have committed current revenues, all that growth in revenues that provides your opportunities to do different things in the future. And again, you know, as we competed, some people might want smaller government, some people might want larger government, but in some sense, it's all preordained. I should be fair about this, too. I really haven't got to the competition on this tax side. I've talked a lot about the spending. There's a fascinating history here, too, where Republicans along about the, well, I'd say the late 70s or so, basically decided they had been this very oppressed minority for a long period of time. They had never really controlled the House of Representatives except for maybe one or two terms. In fact, until Bill Clinton lost the House in 1994. They hadn't had the House for more than 4 years, and they had only had at least in the late 70s, they'd only had two presidents, and they weren't quite sure they wanted to claim either one, which was Dwight Eisenhower and Richard Nixon. So the Democrats were had held the White House most of the time too. And they started examining why they weren't winning. And a fellow by the name of Jude Winensky, who was also a Wall Street Journal editorial writer, Wall Street Journal being the home of what's sometimes called extreme supply-side economics, which is that almost any tax cut will pay for itself. Jude Winensky wrote this article called The Two Santa Theory. In The Two Santa Theory, he said, you know, the reason we keep losing all these elections is the Democrats get to be Santa Claus. We need to be the Santa Claus of tax cuts, the way Democrats are the Santa Claus of spending increases. And so Republicans, along about this time, decided they were no longer going to be deficit hawks either, and they were going to be on the what I call the giveaway side of the budget, giveaway meaning tax cuts or spending increases. And so both parties now started competing more and more on the giveaway side. Now you had two Santa Clauses operating at the same time, sometimes pretending that if they gave away enough on their end, the other Santa would recede into the background, which hasn't happened.
It just the political dynamic is as bad as the economic dynamic there. Just from being at the Concord Coalition for this time, you get when you're talking about tax cuts, Democrats are happy to talk about the deficit and say this is terrible, we can't afford it, and what about the deficit? And then you get talking about the entitlement side of the budget, and the Republicans are happy to talk about the deficit, but blame it all on spending and tax cuts certainly don't contribute to the deficit in their point of view. So everybody has their own political talking points, and it becomes just maddening to try to break through.
I say again, they are in a real political bind in the sense that if they lead on doing deficit reduction, they lose. Essentially, if they lead, they say we're going to renege on some promise to the public, and the other party doesn't buy into that. So this is some theories is called a classic prisoner's dilemma, where the only way you can get to a solution is that both parties have to agree to tackle the problem. So the political dynamic you're mentioning, Bob, is very, very real.
And Gene, I liked your characterization of the sort of the Santa Claus dynamic. And if there's any children listening, cover your ears, because talk about being between a rock and a hard place for organizations like the Concord Coalition talking about fiscal responsibility, because Santa's not real. So we have these two dynamics that are just sort of going off in their own little universe of unreality. And I think this book does a good job of trying to call people back to reality. This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Concord's executive director, Bob Bixby, and Gene Sterley. We're discussing Gene's book, Dead Men Ruling, and its application to present-day policy and politics. And I want to go back to the book here, Gene, with my next question. And you've talked a little bit about some of these factors already, but you break down four specific economic consequences of inaction. One of them was a budget for a declining economy. Can you share a little bit more about the other three, or some other thoughts on the economic consequences of waiting to start dealing with these issues?
Well, one economic consequence is one with which your listeners are quite familiar, and in fact, most readers are quite familiar, which are the deficits themselves. So the deficits create an interesting dynamic, not only in terms of possibly eventually causing a crash or some economic problems, but the growth in interest payments on the debt themselves basically start crowding out other opportunities. You mentioned the budget for a declining economy. That's clearly one. That has to do with the shifting of resources away from what may be the top priorities we have as a nation. I give the example of the reform to welfare that took place in the late 90s. So the aid to families with dependent children was the primary welfare program for the non-elderly in 1960. It was a major cash benefit. However, AFDC, or aid to families with dependent children, never had automatic growth rates built in. And so as a consequence, it actually had to be restored or renewed or reenacted from time to time. It grew a little, but it grew much slower than the economy as a whole. So by the time that Bill Clinton and the Republican Congress agreed that they wanted to undertake welfare reform, that welfare structure had been largely displaced by many other items, including food stamps, now called SNAP, S-N-A-P, a Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program. It had been replaced by the Earned Income Credit. Senator Russell Long had proposed giving more money to people who work rather than giving the maximum amount of money to people at the bottom. And you could agree or disagree with those being good changes, but those changes were easy to enact over time in a world where the existing dominant program was never built so that it automatically usurped other opportunities. Now we have, particularly in areas like health and retirement, we have programs that are scheduled to grow forever faster than the economy for reasons I could get into. But in that sense, they usurp all sorts of opportunities. In fact, they even usurp opportunities with those programs themselves, so that the old, whose problems are growing because of issues like Alzheimer's, are getting an ever smaller portion of the old age budget because the system adjusts in one way by giving us ever more years of retirement, which means we get more and more benefits when we have 15 or 20 years of life expectancy relative to, say, the last 5 or 10 years. So you build in an antiquated government, and it's harder and harder to reform that government over time, largely for reasons I pointed out a long time ago. You've taken away the chance to take the new revenues and spend them on what new opportunities or needs are political demands the public may make.
And you mentioned it being harder and harder to engage in reform with government being more antiquated. Your other consequence for inaction in terms of economic consequences was the government lacking an ability to, or having a less of an ability to combat recessions and address new emergencies. Can you explain that a little bit?
Certainly. So we worry often about the deficit because of the fear of what the problems it might cause, for instance, a crash or a declining rate of growth. But in point of fact, it's harder and harder once the size of the national debt grows. It's more and more difficult to engage in strenuous fiscal policy. If our debt is 30% of GDP and we go into another major recession and need to let it grow to 40 or 50% because of the decline in the economy, that's sort of doable if we set up the system so that once it grows to 40 or 50%, we reduce it back towards 30. As the debt's starting to approach 100% of GDP, it's much, much harder to decide, well, we're going to let it grow again. We've already let it grow, even in good times. So at what point do we have to stop it to be able to not hit some sort of no-return set of policies? And even if I'm wrong economically, there are some economists who argue, well, we're still on the low end. We can always sort of add to that growing debt. Politically, the dynamic becomes much harder, too, because the politicians basically at some point said enough is enough. Whether for good or bad economic reasons, they're very likely to do so. So you're taking away these options. Countercyclical fiscal policy was always meant to be on both sides of an economic cycle, to be able to run more deficits when times were bad in exchange for running fewer deficits when times were good.
Yeah, and I don't know where this sits into the four things, but it seems to me that what you just said is really one of the things that most alarms me, which is that the natural tendency of the deficit or the debt to expand in bad times or in response to a major war and then contract is broken now, that we are running very large and growing deficits, faster than the growth of the economy, in a relatively prosperous time. We're about to break a record for the length of the economic recovery, and without a major military commitment. Obviously, we do have military commitments around the world, but it's not like World War II or even the Vietnam War. So this is a brand new thing, and it's part of the pattern, but I think it's a new manifestation of that, where you could have this. You're in a situation now where just simply freezing the debt to GDP ratio requires very major deficit reduction on a par with like $400 billion a year, according to CBO's latest estimate, just to stabilize the debt to GDP ratio at about 80%. And obviously, we're not looking at tax increases or spending cuts of $400 billion a year. Quite the opposite. Congress is considering new ways to either add money or even extend tax cuts or add new ones. And this is a ominous thing for the future of the economy.
Right. I mean, if where you're at now is always your minimum bound, that when times are bad, you always are going above that bound. You know, if 80% is the minimum level of stabilization, then bad times raise you to 100, then that becomes the minimum bound. And then, and that's actually what we've done.
That's exactly. That has been the pattern. The example that you gave is about what happened, debt to GDP ratio, which had gone up to about 50%, about in the early 90s. Was very high, and it came down all the way into the 30s, I believe, a little bit, maybe under 40% of GDP. And then it went up a little bit, but it had more or less stabilized somewhere around 40% of GDP in the low 40s. And then the Great Recession came, and it shot up very quickly to around where it is now, 78% of GDP. So you would think that now would be the time that would be actually a few years ago would be the time that you'd be coming down. And the thing that's really alarming is that it's going up.
So, Bob, that's a very good point. And one way to simplify a comparison with the past is by looking at the last time we had debt-GDP ratios this high. So some commentators who note that a high debt-to-GDP was something we could overcome refer back to World War II, when we were above 100% of GDP, maybe 120% or so. I'm not sure I got the exact number of GDP, say 1943 or 1944. However, if we had run budget numbers, long-term budget numbers then, say there was a CBO in World War II and it had run long-term budget projections out 10 years, what it would have shown would have been massive, massive surpluses in the future. And why is that? Well, the soldiers and sailors were going to come home. Hopefully the war was going to end. The tax increases, by the way, that had been enacted at the late 30s, early 40s, were a permanent part of the revenue system as well. So spending was going to decline. Revenues were going to stay high. And the major fiscal concern then was we were going to bring the economy back into a recession if we actually let that level of surplus grow. So we didn't do that. But from about 1945 to 1974, we had continual drops in that debt-to-GDP ratio over time, actually on the order of maybe 1.5 percentage points of GDP on average every year. So
it went from over 100% to just over 30%.
Right, right, right. And so we had this very significant drop in the debt-to-GDP ratio. And by the way, those are looked back upon as very good economic times when growth rates were quite high. Now, of course, a lot of that's post-depression. It was for a post-depression period. Still, you can see how you can reduce the deficit and actually still promote economic growth, that you don't have to have continually higher deficits to promote economic growth. And in fact, that almost becomes an impossible scenario, right? At what point does the continually higher deficit have to stop?
Yeah.
And I want to pick up on a couple things there. Bob, you mentioned sort of the magnitude of the difficult decisions that would need to be made by policymakers just to maintain the current debt to GDP ratio. And Gene, you mentioned sort of that lower bound, maybe resetting at almost 80% of debt to GDP moving forward. You did discuss in the book political consequences of waiting to act. And we've talked a little bit about them. But there's one specifically I really want to hone in on, and that is the decline in fiscal democracy. Can you explain that a little bit? What do you mean by a decline in fiscal democracy?
What I'm trying to point out is the lack of what some people call fiscal space or fiscal opportunity is actually also having an impact, I think, on our democratic process. I think it's not just the elected officials who are in a trap in the sense that they don't want to tell the public they've got to renege on a past promise that's been made to them. But I think the public feels hemmed in the sense that they don't feel like their votes are often making a difference. And I'm, again, trying to make this comment on both sides that, yes, they're getting some moderate-sized tax cuts, actually relative to GDP, might be large relative to the debt we already have, but they're not getting smaller government because spending keeps growing. And in fact, if you accept the fact that future taxpayers have to pay for it, They're getting larger government, and liberals are basically, for the most part, abandoning the poor, the middle-class worker. Children's budget is going into decline. And the voters, I feel like something's wrong here. I don't think they fully understand all the numbers or exactly why or how this is happening, but they feel like the democratic process itself is not allowing them to decide the direction of government. And I think that's largely right. I think we're taking democracy out of the hands of the public. Now, if you're a politician on the right or on the left and you firmly believe that you've got to do everything you can to win the battle, not just for today, but for all future times, then you don't really care about democracy so much. You think you've got the answers today, and you don't need to let the democratic process decide them for tomorrow. But I think, as I say, that's foolhardy for a lot of reasons, not the least of which is I think it's really reducing the trust of the public in the government and their ability to change government over time.
And we're unfortunately running short on time, Gene, and we probably haven't left enough time for likely the most important part of this conversation, and that is getting to a better future. So if you could paint the vision that you have or what you communicated in the book or how it applies to today, how do we get to that better future? What steps need to be made?
Right. Well, in the book, I emphasize a lot the extent to which existing revenues are already committed. You know, 80%, 85% of revenues are already committed before Congress walks through the door. Since then, I've been working a lot on one of the set of numbers that I gave to you earlier, which is what's the extent to which growing revenues, the growth in revenues, is pre-committed. The reason I go there is because if you just slow down the rate of growth of those pre-commitments and you create some fiscal slack or some more fiscal democracy, then we can actually both reduce the deficit and allow the public to sense that they're getting something new, for legislators to realize that they can tell the public they're giving them something new themselves rather than simply having that growth be predetermined by past legislators. Now, I see in this world also the opportunity to do things and deal with issues that I think are being neglected. So at the Urban Institute, we've also for years now run a series called Kid Share, where we show the ever-declining projections into the future of what we will spend on kids. I think our educational systems are taking a hit, not just at the higher education level, but even at the K-12 level for reasons having to do with federal and state interactions on health spending. So creating these new opportunities, I think, will create a dynamic that puts us away from this vicious cycle we're on and onto a virtuous cycle of deciding new things that are better for us, but without so much pre-commitment into the future. As I say, you really, in a sense, don't have to renege on existing levels of benefits. The renege is only on the extent to which that growth in benefits is put under control for the left. For the right, it means you're willing to collect enough revenues to pay our bills and not to pretend that putting the bills on a credit card is in any ways a tax reduction for anybody other than current taxpayers at the cost of future taxpayers.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me, Bob Bixby, and Gene Sterley discuss Gene's book, Dead Men Ruling, and its application to present-day policy and politics. Thank you for joining the show, Gene and Bob.
You're welcome, Chase.
After the break, Bob will return to discuss the Congressional Budget Office's report on the long-term budget outlook. We will be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show once again by Bob Bixby. Bob is Concord's executive director. He's a regular contributor on Facing the Future. Welcome back, Bob.
Good to be back.
So today, I want to take just a few minutes here to talk about a report that was just released by the Congressional Budget Office. It's hot off the press. And if we actually use press, I actually read it digitally, but not in the physical paper sense. It is the 2019 report on the long-term budget outlook. Before we talk about what CBO had to say about that long-term outlook, can you give a quick rundown on what this report explains or lays out?
Sure. And in case you were wondering, it was hot off the copy machine for me. So some of us still like to have paper in front of us. The CBO annually puts out a budget and economic outlook, which covers the next 10 years. But going back several years, it began to become obvious that our budget problems were baked into the cake through various structural issues with both spending and revenues. And so you needed to have something that would look beyond the 10-year budget window and see what are the trends if you project them out for 20 or 30 years. And so CBO has gotten in the habit, which I think is a very good one, of every year putting out a 30-year outlook. And it shows that if you keep current spending trends and promises in current law, project them out, and do the same with revenues, where do you end up? What does that do for deficits and debt and the economy? So that's what the long-term outlook is that was put out this week.
And when you mentioned the long-term trends, I think CBO calls those the extended baseline projections, correct?
That's right,
so
yeah.
So what do those extended baseline projections say looking from 2019 to 30 years out?
Well, basically what they're saying is that if the short term doesn't look very good, the long term looks even worse. The trend is for spending to grow at a faster rate than revenues, and that causes a structural mismatch, which means that under the current policies that we have, you get large and growing budget deficits that add to the national debt so that, you know, just the debt held by the public grows from about 78% of GDP where it is now, which is already high by historic standards. We're roughly about where we were as we were coming off the end of World War II. That's where we are now. In the 30-year outlook, the debt to GDP ratio goes up almost double that to close to 150% of GDP within 30 years. And that would be an all-time record, far above the all-time record. So it's on an unsustainable path. And CBO is not, by the way, predicting that this is what is going to happen. They don't predict what is going to happen. They're just saying, like the ghost of Christmas future, if these shadows continue, this is what will happen.
You know, Bob, it's only June. We've had a lot of Christmas or winter references on the show this week. I don't know how I feel about that. We finally had the snow melt just a couple months ago up here in New Hampshire. Going back to the report, when the Congressional Budget Office puts together this report, they take into consideration certain factors, certain assumptions. Do they take into account only existing law, or do they consider where policymakers might go?
Well, they primarily consider current law. That's the baseline, as you mentioned. But they also consider an alternative scenario, which they're not just making up. It's one that is predicated on what would happen if certain tax cuts, which are enacted now, expire when they're scheduled to expire. One of the tricky things with looking ahead is that Congress sometimes sunsets certain provisions, and that's a nice scoring gimmick because you can enact something and assume it's going to sunset in 5 years or something like that, and so you don't get dinged with the spending increase or the revenue loss when you're trying to score your bill. So some of the big tax cut from 2017 actually expires at the end of 2025. And even though nobody, you know, very few in Congress think that that would be a good idea, so CBO says, so suppose they extend those provisions that are set to expire. And on the spending side, there are budget caps, which even now Congress is negotiating, Democrats and Republicans, on how they can be raised. So CBO says, suppose that we assume that those spending caps don't hold, which they have to assume in the baseline. Suppose they just let spending go to where it is, you know, now. It's a lot of complicated thing, but the spending caps actually require a cut. So CBO does an alternative scenario, which is actually much more realistic, I think, than the baseline scenario, because it reflects what Congress has done in the past and is likely to do in the future. And if you do that, the debt held by the public goes up to 219% of GDP by 2049. That's in comparison to 78% where it is now, 144% where it is under the baseline. And so policy really matters here. What Congress does regarding tax provisions and spending provisions that are expiring really can make a huge difference in the debt over the long term.
And if I'm remembering correctly, Bob, 219% of GDP would be more than double the highest ever mark in the history of our nation in terms of measuring the publicly held debt as a percentage of the economy.
Yes, that's right. And if you want to put this in perspective, 2049 is 30 years from now. So Chase, roughly, we're talking about when you're my age. but really, you know, if you start thinking of it in those terms, younger people need to do, because 30 years from now, I'll be lucky to be anywhere. But, you know, the people that are in their early 30s now are looking at a very, very grim scenario of, can you imagine the lost economic opportunities, the enormous amount of debt and interest on that debt that, I mean, you're going to be spending your Social Security check paying off debts.
Well, in more ways than one, when you look at our generation, that we struggle with a lot more personal debt, more student loan debt, a higher cost of living. Like, I'm right there with you, Bob. We're not only looking at budget issues that are going to come home to roost for my generation and the next generation, and perhaps beyond if Congress and policymakers fail to actually act on anything. But there's a whole another set of economic realities that this generation is facing as well.
Well, that's true. And just to make matters even grimmer, one of the problems is slower economic growth. And it's not because of the debt per se, but you look at the demographics, which are affecting the debt, but they also affect the economy. So one of the things that CBO points out is that, you know, we have a much slower growth in the labor force, and that's a big element in economic growth projections, is how fast is your labor force growing, and how robust is the rate of productivity. So you want to have a growing labor force, and you want to have growing productivity, and both of those factors are looking pretty bleak as well because of the aging of the population. We have a much slower growing workforce, and productivity has been pretty stagnant. Part of the reason is the federal government hasn't been doing much on the investment side of the budget for years. So compounding the problem of a budget that's out of whack is an economy that is projected to grow slower than it has in the past. And that compounds the problem and makes it more difficult. It's not like we're ever going to be able to grow our way out of this problem, but certainly a stronger economy would help. And unfortunately, this report is telling us that under current law, we're not going to be able to expect much help from the growing economy.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me and Bob Bixby discuss the Congressional Budget Office's 2019 report on the long-term budget outlook, a report I especially like to look through because I'm very much focused on the long term. I'm, you know, as you mentioned, Bob, in my prime working years, and by the time a lot of these issues will really manifest, will be around the time that I'm looking to retire. So I think it is certainly a report that Congress should take note of. Thank you once again for joining the show, Bob.
Chase, this is a real profile and courage for somebody your age to look at this report.
You've been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.